Welcome to the Behind the Shield podcast. As always, my name's James Gearing, and this week it is my absolute honor to welcome back onto the show SAS veteran, registered psychologist, and human performance consultant, Harry Moffitt. Now, if you didn't hear my first conversation with Harry, it was episode 465, and he discussed a host of topics, including his first book, 11 Bats. In this second conversation, we really take a deep dive into mental health, leadership, stoicism, and so many other areas, including his new book, The Fourth Pillar. Now, before we get to this incredible conversation, as I say every week, please just take a moment, go to whichever app you listen to this on, subscribe to the show, leave feedback, and leave a rating. Every single five-star rating truly does elevate this podcast, therefore making it easier for others to find. And this is a free library of well over 1,100 episodes now. So all I ask in return is that you help share these incredible men and women's stories so I can get them to every single person on planet Earth who needs to hear them. So with that being said, I welcome back onto the show Harry Moffitt. Enjoy. Well, Harry, I want to start by saying thank you so much for taking the time on your morning, my evening, as we return to another discussion on the Behind the Shield podcast today.
No worries. Thanks for having us, James. Good to see you again, mate.
So very first question, people probably can tell from the time difference. Where on planet Earth are we finding you today?
So I'm in sunny Melbourne, which is the southern, southeast, my southern, southeastern major city in Australia. It's soon to be the biggest city in Australia, I believe. But spring's upon us. We're just about out of the winter dross, and so morale is high.
Beautiful. So the last time that we spoke was roughly May, April of 2021. So I would love to dive into some kind of takeaways from that period, you know, as well. But before we do, talk to me about overall, you know, you've transitioned out of the Special Forces profession. You know, what have the last few years been like for you?
Yeah, I left full-time service in 2019 and then qualified as a psychologist and bang into the COVID period, which was, you know, from my perspective, was fascinating to kind of really learn my craft, the street craft of psychology. But yeah, the transition's been good. You know, there's lots to learn and new ways of thinking and being in the world that are different from the military career that I had, nearly 25 years or 30 years in the Defence Force. Yeah, I'm really enjoying it, mate. I feel civilianised now. It's you know, four or five years since we spoke and 5 or 6 years since I left. But I think that's part of the thing. You know, when you leave a Defence Force, or if you leave anything like the Defence Force, your old profession too, in fire and rescue and other kind of mission critical teams, you've got a choice about how you approach it, and you've got to, you know, you can either choose to be to kind of, you know, be to have a mindset of having lost something or lost purpose, or you can go looking for a new one or transforming. And I took on an apprentice's mindset, if you like. I don't particularly love that word, but my attitude was more one of an apprentice. And, you know, I was starting again, re-civilianizing, as I say, and as a psychologist, I've had to learn my craft. And COVID, that period and since, has been that's the kind of attitude I've had. And I really only feel now in 2025, this year, fully confident and confident in my competence as a psychologist. I feel like I belong here and am good at what I do. And you know, the last number of years, I've just been learning about different types of humans, I suppose, and that's been exciting and challenging.
One of the things that I like to do for guests that came on either prior or very, very close to the pandemic is just revisit that time and then look at the ripple effect as well. And the reason being, regardless of what people thought about the decisions at the time, there is no question, unless it was different in Australia, certainly here in the US, that once it was kind of concluded, there was no evaluation period. There was no, well, what do we do well? What do we do poorly? You know, what are the ripple effects? And I think that's a shame, because there's so many lessons that we could learn to be prepared for the next, whatever that thing is. When you reflect back now, especially with this new psychology lens that you have, you know, what were the ripple effects that you've seen in Australia? And, you know, what are some of the lessons that we need to learn from that period so that we don't repeat any mistakes if they were made?
Yeah, it's true, isn't it? We haven't really stopped and done a full AAR or an after action review, if you like. Although I think a lot of institutions and businesses have learned some pretty important lessons from that. My personal reflection on the COVID period was I found it fascinating. I had a license to be out on the street. And I guess for context for your listeners, Melbourne was about the most locked down city in the world. And we had some of the harshest lockdown rules, if you like, and policies. I think we did, you know, 200 plus days of 5 kilometre lockdowns, which mean you couldn't leave the house and you couldn't leave a 5 kilometre area. That was the rules. And people started to get fed up with that in the end. And I wouldn't say, rebelled en masse, but I think, you know, there a lot of people left Melbourne to other states or to the regions. So it was a real issue here for us. But I think the lessons personally, I as I said, found it fascinating. I was able to work with people. I watched people in the clients and extra clients that I took on. I was able to leave my house as a critical service, and I was able to travel to see people and walk with people and meet with people. And certainly mental health declined dramatically. There's no doubt about that. And I think we all know that. But as a society, I think the big lesson we need to learn is how we look after our younger population, you know, and those critical years still feels like that generation of children and adolescents in particular were really dramatically impacted. That will take a little while for it to play out and see just how much damage, a bit dramatic in the language, but how much that's impacted the children, the COVID children and the COVID adolescents, the teenagers of that time. Yeah, when I think about it, if you go back to the depression period, might be something that's within the scope of our understanding, that probably bred more stoic individuals, people who were able to make do with meager means and get on with life and adapt. And certainly we did during COVID. It'll be interesting to see what the long-term effects, you know, analogous effects are of COVID. And I think it will be an element of potentially higher anxiety, or it'll just be interesting to understand how that at a granular level is impacted. But that's what I'd say. Businesses and institutions, I think, have learnt some harsh lessons. I'm in a hedge fund at the moment, and at this end of town, a lot of businesses were exposed online through their technology and their IP and information was guarded online. I think that's a massive lesson. Lots of money was skimmed off big businesses while they all returned home and worked from home and exposed their internal systems to the world. But yeah, I think there's been a huge kind of broad appreciation of the impact of COVID.
It's interesting you use the word stoicism, because one of the things that comes up a lot is how the greatest generation, our World War II veterans, when they returned home from war, you know, they just rolled up their sleeves. And then stoicism, I think, is wrongly applied to someone who kind of buries it down and just gets on with it. And when you hear, as I have on the show, you know, hundreds and hundreds and hundreds of stories of how grandpa, or in some cases dad, was when they returned, there's actually a lot of suffering. There's a lot of people that weren't able to process it. And if you think about, as we progress through these modern years now, if we still have World War II veterans around, we're telling you, well, don't say anything. You're the greatest generation. You've already dealt with it. You just rolled up your sleeves. So, yeah. And you look at, again, like the kind of Hollywood role models that we have when we were younger, the Schwarzeneggers and the Stallones, it's the same thing, that kind of faux stoicism. So what are your observations between real stoicism and this kind of facade of, you know, stoicism, this faux masculinity that a lot of us were subjected to when we were younger?
Yeah, there's a real popular stoicism. So firstly, to you know, the former generations, when you were talking then, I was just thinking, it's funny, at the moment I hear a lot about this generation and maybe the COVID generation being softer and needing to toughen up, and I'm not so sure that is how history will reflect on them. They're a different generation. There's no doubt about it. When the soldiers returned from World War One, there was a sense that the fatherless children were, they'd created a generation of which. So things like Outward Bound and Scouts, and you know, returning children out into to nature to toughen them up, because there was a sense that they had that they were a weaker generation. But they went off to World War II and did a pretty bloody good job, the 18-year-olds and 17-year-olds. And we're in danger of repeating that, I think. They are a different generation. But yeah, I think that's where the stoicism, or the faux stoicism, as you say, the popular stoicism, can do a disservice. If you dig deeper into the Stoics, going right back to Zeno and Cato, where the kind of Stoic ideals come out of, it's not a simple philosophy about just toughening up and weathering out the storm. That's not the point of Stoicism. The point of Stoicism, you know, they were geologists, they were natural philosophers, they were cosmologists, they did mathematics, you know, that the whole bunch of things spawned at the same time. But we've just resolved it down. And through Marcus Aurelius and that Romantic period of Stoicism, we've really reduced Stoicism down to this kind of one trick pony, if you will. And that is challenging, because if that's what people believe, that they should just toughen up, that's not how life works. And if you really do dig into the Stoics, that's not exactly what they were saying. I think in terms of how we apply Stoicism today, I think it's one aspect of a broad range of philosophical thinking that we can apply to living. And it frustrates me a little bit that Stoicism seems as the primary philosophy. It's one of thousands of different philosophical positions. And this is the point I make in my book, is that, you know, you are a philosopher, we philosophize. It's actually an ability we all have to wonder about the world, to wonder about ourselves, to self-reflect, to be awed when you look into the night sky. And as an ability or a capacity that humans have, I believe that we can both enhance that, and we can let it, or we can let it squander and just be a passive passenger in our own development. So I think Stoicism, to summarize that, Stoicism's much, much more than just controlling what you can control and ignoring what you can't. And that's not what they said. You don't ignore what you can't control. You're very interested in that. But we've got to remember that Stoicism as it is today is just one type of philosophy. The existentialist philosophy, which I love, the 16th and 17th and 18th century, I think gives you a different perspective about what it means to be in the world, the phenomena of life and existence. In the book, I go into a little bit of depth and offer other philosophies.
What is different about a lot of these periods where deep thought seemed to be, you know, revered in some cases, and what is happening today, where one would argue could possibly be the worst time when it came to promoting individual thought and forging community?
Yeah, I think it seems, it appears to us that around 500, 600, or say 300 to 600 BCE before the Common Era, it appears to us that societies were more open to the prophets, the philosophers, the deep thinkers, the scientists of then that period. But it's probably not the case. These were the societies, the Greek society that we kind of anchor around, were authoritarian rule, states at war. And I think that's an important thing to think about too. They're permanently at war. Nation states are in defensive postures, so it generates a different way of thinking, I think. But there are schools of thought that believe that it was around this time, a few thousand years ago, that humans started to, there was a kind of an awakening, and that the voice in our heads, the commentary in our heads, wasn't God talking to us or the gods controlling us from above. But what if this voice in our head is actually being generated by us? And so that fluorescence of thinking and contest of ideas and the status quo that we see when we look back through history, that we imagine, that period appears to be a period where humans, as I said, kind of awakened. As things evolved in the book, I make the not unique or radical claim that as humans evolved through the Romanic period, the Abrahamic religion started to take control, and that the last thing you want as a religious body for people to do is to think for themselves. You know, there's a book here now that we do the thinking. Here's the rules, you obey the thinking. And so for the last couple of thousand years, it's arguable that we've been in an obedience kind of mindset, if you like, as societies. And that has had some really dramatic ramifications for people who think for themselves. You know, Copernicus, Galileo, I mean, Socrates going right back, were all burned at the stake or killed for their, executed for their, or you know, marginalized for the heretical act of thinking for themselves. And I think to some degree that remains today. It's still one of the most courageous and radical acts that you can show, is to think for yourself and have a different idea and push back against the status quo. And we're seeing that play out in real time. So I guess to answer the question, you know, there's a historical antecedent for this and precedent, that it is difficult for individuals to think for themselves. And it's only small. Yeah, if I think of people, radicals that do have thought for themselves, one of your countrymen, if you like, Christopher Hitchens, who was very courageous. He was a bit of a showman and did it for good purposes, but also for, because he enjoyed being that showman. But I think he's one of the modern minds that I really appreciate as someone who really thought for themselves, was widely read, understood a lot about a whole range of intellectual histories and intellectuals. And I think he was someone who thought for himself, and I've referred to him a couple of times in the book.
I have said this many, many times. It seems like the lessons from a lot of the ancient wisdom, whether it's obviously Greek and Roman and some of these other ones, whether it's the holy books, you know, of all these different religions, the common denominator really seems to be don't be a dick. If you're really boiling it down, you know, it's the kindness, compassion, empathy, community, and every single text can be taken the wrong way. I mean, we're seeing it at the moment in the Middle East, for example. But at the core, if you look at the masses, you know, these are lessons learned. And I think that a lot of humanity was trying to tell us, hey, we tried war and torture and it doesn't work. It's not, no one's happy. You know, there's a few people that are making a lot of money and are very powerful, but the rest of us are suffering. Why do you think now, after millennia that was still seeing humans able to distort what I would argue was very kind and compassionate text.
Yeah, I just don't think we learn our lessons, James. It's a pretty simplistic thing to think about. There's a condition, there's a human condition that at the center of it is fear, and maybe it's a result that we are scared little creatures in the corner of a universe, scared of the dark still, and scared of people that we don't know. So there's something in our condition as humans, in the human condition and human nature, that lends itself to that. I mean, if you take on Emil Durkheim's position that we are trapped in this anemone, this kind of almost a self-suicide kind of dystopian view of the world, there's elements of truth to that, I think. And thus why we need kind of to self-soothe on self-help and other things. It seems more problematic at the moment because we seem to be atomizing or withdrawing from a collective and community, which gives us which builds resilience in not only us as individuals but as communities. You touched on it there. I think that we have lost our focus, I suppose, on the most important thing, I think, for all of us, and that is to be a great citizen. Foremost, I'll almost put it before parenting, before doing good in the world, is to be a good community member and a good citizen. And that's how we've been as social animals for a long, long time. And we just haven't reached this level of sophistication. The answer is probably not a single point, but I think the answer to why we still grapple with war and fear and anger as human beings at the center or the core of being a human being is not because we have evolved to this. It's because we're still evolving. We just haven't reached that level of sophistication yet, and that's okay. We're not. This isn't the end of humanity. We've built all these wonderful things around us, which I would argue are now bloody killing us as well. But we are evolving, there's no end state here. There's no outcome. We seem focused on wanting outcomes and answers and solutions, and the reality from my perspective is they just don't exist. We're kind of wandering through the world. There's a spontaneous order that's limited and constrained by its past, by the history, by its history, and we're not. There is no future end state. We're just adapting as things go, and accidentally to a large extent. In fact, I would argue accidentally completely. If you look at the eye, for example, it's evolved over a period. Without going into it too deeply, the human eye has the fovea in the back of it, which is the blind spot in every eye where the nerves and cell leads come in through the back of the eye and populate the rear surface of the eye. Now, if there was someone controlling the design of the eye, or if there was some higher order controlling the design of the eye, if an engineer was designing an eye, they would not put a blind spot or a fovea in the back of the eye. They would have complete 360 degree vision. And so that just makes my point that over evolution, it just does the best with what it has in front of it now, and we have imperfections built into us that remain, that we probably won't be able to evolve out for a very long time. So I think just understanding that, and this is kind of one of the aspects of Stoicism and other philosophies, is that it's all kind of accidental. We're just bumping around in the dark, making this up on the run, and that's what's baked into the system. So we're always going to be not only as individuals a work in progress and accidentally bumping along through life. As a species, we're the same. I just hope that we can realize the woes of our ways quick enough that there are future generations to populate the earth.
It's funny, first you talk about the eye. My wife just came out of optometry school. It's doctoral optometry. So I've been acutely aware of the eye for 5 years because she keeps showing me all the study materials and everything.
It's the go-to example of evolution. It's a great example.
Absolutely. Speaking of evolution, it's a good segue. Excuse me. I just watched a show called Any Last Words, and it is a film writer, actually, a script writer, who interviews people at the end of their life cycle, whether they're, I don't know if he's only the terminally ill, but this one was Jane Goodall. And so they did the recording, just the two of them in the studio, did not release it until she passed away, and then they just released it on Netflix. And she was talking about chimpanzees having this innate aggression when it came to other chimps. You know, again, they didn't recognize them. And this is kind of ties in with what you're saying and something I believe in. I think the evolution of man is kindness, compassion, community. I really do. You know, the community has been there tribally, but if you look at how horrendous some of the chapters were in, you know, millennia ago, you know, humans could be incredibly cruel, incredibly brutal. And even though that's still happening in some pockets of the world, I would argue that a lot of us are evolving. So to me, if we want to continue evolving as a species, then the wars and the nastiness and the division is regressing as a human species. And it's actually kindness, compassion, empathy, in my opinion, that is the evolution of man.
Yeah, Steven Pinker would probably argue that we're getting better, that we are evolving in the right direction, and you know that there's less poverty and less depravity, and you know, more freedom and more recreational time. And I kind of agree with that to a point, but I don't think it's that way for everyone. You know, there's, without getting kind of too deep into it, you know, we're probably too many of us for a start, and on the planet, and also driven by driven by deeper urges that now manifest in money and power and those types of things, that they're not going away. But it is hard, and I guess in the book, this is what I'm asking everyone to do. It seems to me humans are kind of speeding up. I'm not sure the world's getting more complex. That's arguable. I'm still kind of, the jury's out for me on that. But what I think we're doing is just living life faster. And the analogy I use, you'll do this, James, you read books at 1.5 now. You know, you don't read them and thumb through them as much as you should. It's remiss. I think it's actually now a radical elite practice, reading a book from cover to cover. But, you know, if you think about you listen to books on 1.5, and that seems to me the perfect metaphor for how the next generation's coming through, the young men and women that I work with daily in sports, mission critical teams, and business. They're just in so much of a hurry. They want everything yesterday, and meetings are, you know, they want to find more productivity in their meetings and shorter times to do this. And I mean, that's, you can't have that kind of productivity gains forever. It seems remiss. And where I see it play out the most is in parenting. So it's not long, if I have a chat with a 30, 35-year-old man, for example, a young man up and coming in the world, and he's got a couple of kids, it's not long before the conversation kind of bypasses prioritization and work and meetings and performance and all the rest of it back to family. And they seem intent on having a holiday Olympics every weekend, you know, jamming everything in. And I said, what's wrong with just going home and switch your phone off and just go and hanging out down the oval, you know, or down the park or something, and just bloody slow down? And I think that's part of the issue here, is that we're all on this 1.5x listening to books and living our lives. And the ultimate message in the fourth pillar is to slow down and take note. You know, Jane Goodall was probably a great exponent of that. You know, she actually stepped out of society, went and lived with the apes. Bit strange. I'm not sure that I'd be up for it. I like my Guinness way too much, but I've got so much respect for her. And I think it would be negligent of anyone to not listen to such a beautiful thinker, beautiful mind, you know, and she was the best, a great example of the best a human can be. I think people like Jane Goodall have always respected, the elders. It really behoves us all to listen to those people, and I think the message would be, if I haven't seen that interview, would be, you know, enjoy this great gift that we have.
It's funny because she literally talks about being in an airport and watching two birds like basically flirting with each other, doing kind of a mating routine, and people are all walking by on their phones and they're missing this kind of, you know, nature moment, as it were. And she, at the same time, you know, travels the world because she's such a passionate conservationist that she's also subject to this busyness as well. So I'm sure she probably fought to find balance.
Commodity by stealth, and I think that's a great point. It, you are missing the rest of life and what humans are supposed to. But so raise your eyes, get off your phone, and notice these types of things, because I think your ability to wonder and be in the world and experience the world is impoverished if you don't tend to it all the time.
Yeah, 100%. And I have that battle myself, and sadly it's because social media is what I use to disseminate the podcast and some of the ideas. But it is, at 51 years old, you know, we had a childhood with zero phones. It's still so pervasive, you know. And if you allow yourself to go down that line, that monkey mind just starts amplifying. So I can't imagine being a child that was raised on that, especially. I mean, it kills me, but you see these kids, you know, the strollers have devices strapped to them, and these children are, you know, barely a year old, and that's been your norm the whole time. And as you said, now you've got that 1.5 mentality. You know, what is the ability to just sit quietly under a tree now? It's hard enough for our generation that have been exposed to technology, but a kid that's only ever known screens, how hard is it to get them to simply sit and watch two birds playing?
Impossible. And I fear the ramifications down the track.
Well, but one more kind of, you know, lateral question before we dive into the book a little deeper. Something that's really kind of, you know, made me go, you know, question things a little bit recently is trying to get your head around some of the most toxic, divisive people that we see presented in front of us. So, for example, in America, I make this comment many, many times, there's 340 million of us. And yet you hear the lesser of two evils every time we're down to the last two. You look at the CEOs of cigarette companies and fast food companies and drug companies and weapons manufacturers who sleep soundly in their beds, knowing that their products are killing hundreds of thousands, if not millions of people around the globe. And it made me realize that I'm sure the last time you and I spoke, when we were talking about mental health, we were looking at the soldier, the firefighter, but we never talk about the CEO. The presidential candidate. In this interesting kind of journey that you've been in, you know, through the military and then obviously beyond now to this corporate space and the sporting space, what are your observations on the element of sociopathy in some of these key roles? And does that need to be a conversation about the ability to actually do your job if you have lost your ethical spectrum as a president, as a CEO of a company that's producing something that's actually detrimental to the nation?
Yeah, I'd love to see ethics and aesthetics. They go hand in hand under kind of an axiological way of thinking or philosophical kind of school or branch. I don't think it's really taught in management schools. I think management schools are about productivity, profit, outcomes, control, predictability, those types of things. And that's okay to an extent, but to be able to see the broader picture, I don't think that our CEOs and commanders and other people are being well serviced. We've got this managerialistic view on the world. It's highly competitive. Eyes, if there's such a word, you know, we make it about competition. We don't make it about getting along with the next people. You know, you're not going to turn that ship around anytime soon. the detrimental side of, you know, the military industrial complex, the pharmacological industrial complex, all of these different that are driven by profit and productivity and competitiveness. I don't think that's going anywhere soon, but I do see and have seen the real fallout for CEOs. I spend more time than you probably think with 65-year-old men in particular who are struggling with what's it been for, that a real question. And because it takes an enormous feat of an enormous amount of energy and emotional energy, and I would put spiritual kind of energy, spirit, to maintain the delusion that what you're doing is meaningful to the world and productive in a community, collaboratively community sense. It takes an enormous amount of effort to maintain that delusion, and also to surround yourself with people that can help you do that. So, and this is real. You know, people will roll their eyes and say, he's gone lefto, pinko, or whatever. And that's just not the case at all. But there's a reality to this. And those men who you sit with, they're unsure. You can see the facade that they've put up. I spoke about this recently. There's kind of a facade. This is the way I think of it, a facade that we all have. We have a persona out in front, whether that's, Harry Moffat, the author, or the psychologist, or the human performance, or whatever facade that I build to project into the world for whatever means I need that to be for. Self-promotion for the book, or reputation to get more work as in a business sense. But for some of these men that I sit with, and again, I use men deliberately, the rest of their life behind that facade is atrophied. You know, the relationships they had with their high school or university friends, they're real. Those relationships are really, for all of us, are very strong, and we should foster those as we grow. Their connection to their family and their kids is not as, it's not flourishing as much as it could or it should. Connection to grandchildren, surrounded by great wealth, but not necessarily surrounded by those meaningful community connections, and in a lot of cases, family connections as well. And I really feel for them. You know, it's easy to go dismiss them and say, well, they're fat, rich and greedy and they should bugger off and they've had their show. But I kind of feel for them, and I think that's has potential to be getting worse, not better. I think there's a real case for guidance, and I feel like I provide that a lot in my role now. It's kind of a guidance to say, hey, sure, be healthy, be fit to sustain yourself, to enjoy life and have a great, but what about your view of the world and your connection to your community, and how are we doing, how are we going to keep that alive while you're progressing through business, et cetera? The other kind of is just quickly zooming out from that, the macro, businesses too, this is where corporates, I don't think, can have an ideal culture. In fact, what is culture? I'm not even sure still what that is, but there's a contest, for people to be at their best, for businesses to be at their best, for a business to have a central feel good vibe about it, which all bosses and leaders want. We need transparency and truth and a relationship built on honesty. Whereas in the business world, profit and progress and competition necessarily by its business model is not true, truthful, honest. It's deceptive, obscures facts, and has to play the pea and thimble trick on the side of the alley to maintain a competitive advantage. So, they're in contest, and we don't talk about those things and what the impacts are. And I think we should be, especially with our generations coming through.
Absolutely. I think one of the things that this parallel, whether you're, you have things that happen when you were younger and it's created some sort of you know, void in your soul. And so you feel driven to put a uniform on, which is an honorable thing. And hopefully along the way, you start to see these struggles and you deal with them. And then that becomes a strength and you're a better soldier or a better firefighter. And I think it's the same with business. There's a lot of people, their void is power and money. And it really does show so brightly in some of the biggest figures that we see, you know, like here at the moment, the commander in chief. I mean, it's clearly there's some unaddressed childhood trauma going on there. And it's a shame because you could take that broken child. It could be an incredibly warm, caring human being that maybe was also a good leader. But I can see how some of these people now that you interact with, the same as the soldier that's transitioned out and hasn't addressed the thing beneath the thing, as they say, that no matter how much money, no matter how much power, no matter how many franchises, I guarantee that there's I'm making an assumption now that there's an essence of it was never enough to fill that void.
Yeah, and it goes back to what we're talking about earlier, you know, this being scared little creatures in the corner of the universe, afraid of the dark, afraid of each other. And I think that stands. That's where humans are in our evolution. And you're not fixing that anytime soon. That goes for all of us. It doesn't matter whether you're commander in chief or meager little Harry Moffat in Melbourne.
So going to the book, the last time you spoke, you wrote an incredible book about war and cricket. So what made you dive into the world of stoicism and then talk to me about the four pillars?
Yeah, I've always been interested. I was fortunate enough in my life. I was surrounded by books. My father was an intellect. He was a sailor in the Navy, but he was a deep thinker, read a lot. You know, I had some beautiful books around me too. You know, I think when you're a kid and you've got nice, beautiful books like an old Shakespearean. I never read this book, but I used to flick through it and just fumble it, and it was beautiful. The old Encyclopedia Britannica with their gold edges and the leather kind of, yeah. It was always a secondhand set or borrowed from a car sale or bought from a car sale, boot sale. But I was very fortunate, so I'd thumb through those books. I love books, and I think books have lost their way. I talk at nauseam about them in the book. So I was very fortunate, and I remember seeing early images of, you know, Socrates, Plato, and Aristotle, and these things capturing my mind. Old men with beards, bald old men with beards, some of the ideas as I came through my teenage years. And as I said, I've never read a complete William Shakespeare, but I've got lots of books who people who pick through The Tempest and Macbeth and all those types of things. So I had a fascination with that level, I suppose, of thinking. But it wasn't until, until I got through my teenage years and joined the military that I reinvigorated my love of philosophy and psychology, which is the grandchild almost of philosophy, comes in partnership with that. And when I started studying, I wanted to do philosophy. I did some minors in philosophy, but you were never going to make much money out of being a philosopher, particularly out in the business world, which is where I had an eye to practice, and that was pretty early. So psychology was it, and it's a great way to marry philosophy. As I said, you know, up until a couple of hundred years ago, there was no such thing as psychology. There was no such thing as science. It was all called natural philosophy, and the great philosophers up until, you know, a couple of few hundred years ago were, you know, dipped their toe in everything from history to philosophy to medicine to cosmology, the whole nine yards. It wasn't until then that we had sciences breaking up into or these different areas breaking up into sciences. So, you know, that was it for me. And I guess this book's been kind of burning away inside me. In fact, the real book's still burning away, like we all have one burning away, and you know that better than most, James. This is kind of my first furtive steps into an area that I'm passionate about, which is kind of human performance, whatever that is. It's still emerging. It's in its absolute infancy at the moment. And I think that there's a part that's always been missing for me in high performance and human performance since I set up a program for our special forces here in Australia. You know, most high performance or human performance programs are based around the three pillars, which is the physical, psychological, and social pillars. And any performance program or management kind of framework will borrow and lean heavily into those three aspects, and it's really out of the biopsychosocial model of disease, but that has evolved over time. And so for me, when I was looking into the world back in, you know, midway through my service with the regiment, when I was looking to the world and interested in how we prepare and maintain our operators, I saw these models, but I always had a sense there was something missing, because when you think about it, all human performance and high performance programming, which is where human tech interfaces at its most interesting, as far as I'm concerned. If you think about Formula One racing, the human tech interface, or you think about soccer or football, you know, football, there is no tech out in the field really. It's kind of monitoring from afar, but the human still dominates the tech there. And these are why I'm fascinated by these domains. But it's all about outcomes. It's all about performance. It's all about the part of the human, not the whole human. And so NFL is one of the great examples. They treat their operators like a bunch of racehorses, and they train them to within an nth of their life around one thing. If you're a forward in NFL or defensive, what are the front rowers called in
the
NFL? The lineman, your job is simply be fast over 5 meters and push a guy around, you know. But we tend not to look at any other part than that. And what I'm asked calling for with the fourth pillar, which is the philosophical pillar, is for us to zoom out and appreciate the whole of the human, and not just the part that we're interested in for profit, progress, or winning, as is the case in athletics. And a guy by the name of Percy Cerity, I could talk all day about him, but I'll keep very brief, who is well known in the US in a kind of subcultural kind of way. He's the greatest coach of all time. There I said it. You know, he raised a stable of amazing athletes, world champions, Olympic champions, all from a tin shack on the southern beaches of Victoria here in Australia, by himself, without high performance programs, without big gyms, without mental skills training and all the rest of it. He just had a philosophy that encompassed all of this, and his position to summarize it was that yes, he can create good physical, mental, and social creatures for performance and win gold medals, which he did dozens of times. But he wanted to create the whole human. And at the core of his performance program, if you will, framework, was a philosophical grounding. And one of the greatest runners of all time, Herb Elliott, said you didn't go to Percy to be trained to become someone who can run laps really fast. You went there for a life's education, and that's what I would like to see. I think it's an obligation for our high performance and human performance systems to do that.
So if you could kind of sum it up as far as the principles and philosophies for that in, for example, the fire service, what is missing and what will be brought into that conversation?
Well, there's a lot missing. I think it depends on the first part is what is the framework now. Most human performance frameworks in the mission critical team area are inadequate, not because anyone's not good at organizing. It's just that we haven't kind of evolved that far to resource how we treat humans and grow humans enough yet, or giving it enough priority. You know, the fire service is in the business of creating firefighting human platforms. You know, that's kind of it. And it's the same in the military. We need military warfighting platforms. And that's kind of where we're at the moment. And I guess so what's missing and what do we add in? That's the discussion I've attempted to start in the book. because there's no great solutions out there, and there's certainly not a sympathetic ear, particularly in the money managing department, the bean counters department, to put more money into your local, James, your local fire brigade or fire off stations, how we manage humans in that sense. And that's why I've deliberately picked the high performance areas of life. And in the mission critical team world, it's probably the special operations world, where they put a lot of money and effort into training, maintaining and sustaining their operators. They've got the time, the wherewithal and the resources to do that, because of the nature of war fighting is you go away to fight wars and then you come home and recover and you've got lots of time around the gym. And athletes, athletic environments where they have all the time in the world to spend crafting humans. So the book really is, hey, this is where we're at, this three-pillar focus, biopsychosocial kind of focus. It's overly and in an unbalanced way focused on outcomes, progress, profit, winning. And that's cool. I'm not saying we shouldn't want to win, because I love my sports as well. But and certainly in war, we want to win. But have we gone too far? And how do we rebalance this so that humans during their careers, from the start of their careers, are well connected to the world, well connected to their communities outside of what they do for a living, and so that that part of their life doesn't atrophy at the cost of win at all costs, if you like. I sit with athletes, and it doesn't take long before the discussion comes to I'm just a cog in this machine. That's really quite sad. If we have them thinking about themselves in that way, it's very mechanistic, and I think there's just a deeper level to untap here, and goes to transitioning at the end of life, and goes to the way you think of yourself and how you view the world.
It's interesting, because I've had that same conversation with a lot of athletes and coaches here in the States. And I don't know if it's the same in Australia, but I know certainly when I was growing up in the UK, unless you were that kind of golden child football player that was being groomed in, these youth leagues and going to end up in Liverpool or Manchester United, the rest of us were just playing sports. But if you look at youth sports here in America, they are squeezing such a high level of performance out of high school and college kids, and then they break. And then you have this complete, nosedive, where now our 30-year-olds have got all these stories about how they were this high school athlete, if it wasn't for their ACL, MCL, whatever. And now they're deconditioned, and now they're obese, and now they're struggling with their identity. And it is a huge disservice to the well-being and the longevity of these young athletes. And if you look at the fire service, and I'm including Australia, because I've seen a lot of my friends post, from Australia as far as the struggles they've had, it's that same misprioritization where, again, like you said, disposable heroes. Well, there's someone in a seat, so we're good, rather than how do we forge longevity and performance in these people that we ask to show up on our very, very worst day. But what we have is, if you see strength and conditioning and nutritionists come to our professions, it's a try not to die less conversation, not a tier one forging performance conversation. So just as a closing thing, because I know we're going to be mindful of your time, how do we get, let's just focus again on the fire service, police, EMS, how do we get society to look at the way, the value of these professions and invest in these people so they can perform at the highest level, but also have a long and fruitful career and then retirement?
Yeah, well, I think we're getting to that. So if I was to answer the golden answer is that resourcing, making time, prioritizing humans over hardware. It seems when we want to buy new kit and new, let's look at, information management systems that seem to change every 3 years and cost $1 billion to transfer and upgrade, et cetera. If we prioritize that less and increased prioritization on the human factor, we might have a few more people through the door, be able to sustain them and maintain them for longer and take the hurt off the people who are doing all the work with less resources, less time and less people for a start. But that's not going to happen anytime soon. You know, I think acting at a local level is really important. You know, you made a really good point about athletes, and they're a good example. And I think they are a good exemplar for the mission critical teams, like fire and rescue. They go into a system at 14. These days it's even younger, 12, and they're in that system for 10, 15 years, some of them, and they're chasing the dream. They're moving around inside the system at lower levels of competition, and in the NFL, like, you know, college football, I'd stay there or go and compete elsewhere, but they keep the dream alive until, I don't know, you know, 25, 30 years old, or they have a career-ending injury. And Percy Cerity would fume at that, because his philosophy was that we spend so much time investing in that athlete and not only, you know, not only these days in their physical and mental capacities, but their social capacity. In the book, I make the point that the social element or pillar has been the fastest evolving recently. It was, you know, 15 years ago, no one would have said, I love you or care for you or spoke about mental health in men's context anyway. But he would say that we build up this embodied wisdom in a young athlete. We spend all these resources that we pump into, and we make this great human being that has a great understanding of themselves, physically, mentally, etc. And then we squander it. Then we just kind of ship it off. And the greatest responsibility as a society is to help these individuals who are exceptional. There's no way of putting it. There's no gold stars for anyone in my camp, mate. So there's the individuals that have all this fortune enough to have all, we need them to go on to become great citizens and to go on to the world and run the world for us. You know, in embodied wisdom is common sense, and that's kind of lacking. You talked about who's running the planet at the moment. I think Elon Musk should pick them all up, all these nutbags, jump on a ship and go and test out his trip to Mars with those if they're the biggest brains on the planet.
Jane Goodall literally said the exact thing that you said. One of her parting words to this planet after, you know, before she died, is exactly what she said. He could get on a spaceship with Trump and Putin, some other people, and go explore Mars.
Yeah, well, that's great. That's a great endorsement, because I talk about it in the book. You know, if you want to do something, if you're an explorer, go and explore, mate, and take all your buddy. Anyway, but so this embodied wisdom that's collected, we need to do something with it. It's just stupidity to let them wander off into the world and go and live on a Mediterranean yacht somewhere. And they want to. It's evident. All of these athletes who reach the top level, what do? They almost to a person come back and give back. That's what they're overarching. You speak to anyone that they have this overwhelming desire to want to give back. So there's a human innate quality that we all have to want to give back. And I can tell you now, I'm nearly 60 years old. That has overtaken my drive for business, for money, for accolade, for reputation. This book's not Harry reaching out to the world wanting to one-up everybody else or anything. This book is speaking not to you, James, I'm sorry to say, but it's speaking to the operator, to the 22-year-old man and woman. And I'm so rapt. The book's been really well received. Football clubs have picked it up, and the young athletes are saying this really hit a note with me and how I look at myself and what I do for myself. Yeah, the last thing I'd say to that end is it's the same with our mission critical team operators, and it's more important. The world is not getting easier to police or to rescue or to put out or to fix up once they're bent and broken. And you're dead right, mate. We turn up on the worst day. A person's worst day is our every day. You think of an athlete embodying that wisdom, then I think it's 2, 3, 4x that a mission critical team operator learns about the world, not only about themselves and how to compete in a sporting context, but also in a mission critical team operator, they learn about the world, the worst of humanity, what it means to be compassionate, what it means not to be compassionate, what it means not to be empathic, and what it means not to be a good community member. And these are lessons that humanity cannot afford to squander. And here we are. It's what we do relentlessly, almost. You know, when I go back and speak with special operators now, in a mentoring and an elders kind of role, if you will, I embrace that role. The first conversation I had to them is, "What's your plan B and plan C?" Well, that's the very first, and it kind of takes them aside, because all they think is, "Oh, see themselves as this, you know, war platform, human fighting platform, whatever is pumped into them," because it could all be over tomorrow. And this is only a part of who you'll be. So you need to be someone else at the same time. And as hard as that is, or as hard as that sounds now, it'll make perfect sense later. But trust me, you need to be a whole lot more and treat, you know, all parts of who you are. And I think that's our greatest responsibility. And I really hope this book kicks off at least a discussion. I'm not a philosopher, so it's not about philosophy in that sense. It's about my own philosophy. I don't own the corner store on human performance programs. I know nothing. All I know is that I've learned from a lot of better thinkers than me. But I agree with Percy Cerity that it's a philosophical, whatever that is for you, a philosophical capacity within us that has deteriorated and is in danger of being impoverished in our outcomes focused world. And in this book, clumsily maybe and definitely at times, I try to outline what is why we need philosophy back in our life and how we can implement the praxis of philosophy in and around not only life but these high performance programs, where I think they have the greatest opportunity to show us and how we can do better for all of us in the world.
Absolutely. It's such a refreshing concept too. I mean, the kind of fusion between the kind of career that you had for a long time and now this philosophical element that was part of your early life too. So, I mean, it really is, it's nice to hear something other than the kind of same old leadership stuff that we get told over and over and over again. Being mindful of your time, people listening, where can they find the book? Where can they learn more about you online?
So I'm on LinkedIn. And the book's available, just Google The Fourth Pillar on Modern Stoicism and the Philosophy of High Performance, a bit of a mouthful name, but just Google The Fourth Pillar, Harry Moffat, and there's available on all Audible platforms. And we're trying to break into the US. That'll take a little while, but having some success. I'd love to have it distributed and published in the US or the UK, but it's always hard from Australia. But you can, it is available through Amazon. So I've been actually quite pleasantly surprised at how many people are picking up from the US, both Audible and the hard copy.
Brilliant. Well, I want to thank you so much for yet another incredible conversation. It really has been amazing. So I want to be mindful of your time, though. So thank you so much for being so generous with your time and coming on the Behind the Shield podcast.
Thanks, James. And congratulations to you, mate. I'm excited about, probably can't say too much about what's coming up for you, mate, and can't wait to see, read, and hear more about it.